Session. John Miller is the Executive Director of Population Health Surveillance and Disease Control with the Provincial Health Services Authority in British Columbia. John.
Well, thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure to just hear the speakers this morning so far. It's really inspiring. I'm standing in front of you now as a physician and a physician working at a health authority in British Columbia. But I want you to know I spent 10 years of my life living and working in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, where it's a zero cash culture. There's no money at all there. Yet these people had natural resources, they had culture, they had happiness. So you can live without money, I'm aware of that. But now I'm going to really put this into the context a little bit of BC and Canada. British Columbia, you'll be interested to know, has the best health as measured by life expectancy in the world. We have the highest life expectancy ahead of Japan in the world. But we also have the highest child poverty rates in Canada and have had that distinction for 6 years running. And this high average health status is a bit of a misleading because it lies over the top of huge inequities. We have a 10-year spread in life expectancy between the worst off and the best off. So it's a bit misleading and can lead to complacency. But we have genuine poverty in British Columbia. 15 to 20% of children in British Columbia are being brought up in poverty. And I'm talking poverty where you cannot actually afford to adequately feed your family after you've paid for some notion of shelter and clothing and transport. So there is genuine poverty widespread in Canada. I mean, we have the worst. Quebec is the best province to live in because they have more social supports there. So the poor people in Quebec die at much less rate than they do in British Columbia. But nonetheless, we have way more poverty in Canada than is widely found in Europe. The Provincial Health Services Authority is in business to provide high-end care, cancer, heart disease, renal, et cetera, et cetera. That's our $2 billion a year budget to provide health care. My part of it is to prevent some of those diseases because, as somebody said earlier, we are going off the cliff with health care. I'll come back to that. The title here, Powerful Strangers, draws on two notions. One is, first of all, from complexity theory, and some of you will know about the notion of strange attractors in complexity science that can lead to small changes that then create powerful changes. And that's what we're really trying to get to here, is how we can create small changes leading to massive social change, like or at least accelerated change that Mark was talking about. But the other piece here is around powerful strangers is I've been working personally as a public health physician for 20 years trying to get traction on the determinants of health and getting relatively little traction. And in asking politicians why not, they said, because you're coming up with the usual messages. We know what you're going to say. You've got to line up with some powerful strangers. You've got to come up with the unusual suspects. And for us, that's become the business world. So that's what I'm going to be talking about, how we partner with people in business to address what Sir Michael Marmot has said is the inequitable distribution of money, resources, and power that leads to the poor health outcomes we have worldwide. And Sir Michael, that's an extremely useful bit of rhetoric that you've provided for us. It's a very, very powerful message. Thank you for that. So just to flip through here, why do we need business at the table? Well, we are looking at these so-called complex or wicked problems, huge ones, that cannot be solved by governments alone at all. We need the so-called joined-up government approach. But even with a joined-up government, even with all levels of government, federal, provincial, municipal, it won't be enough to solve these problems. Why is that? Because the business interests are far more powerful, and it's the business into the non-social side of business that's driving us into poor health. The people that are selling sweetened beverages and fast foods and fattened, salt-laden foods, the people who design our communities that are in sprawl, the people that encourage us to use cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we can't possibly solve these things without engaging business, both to provide resources but also to change their practices. So we are looking for mechanisms to do that, and I mentioned in that second bullet a postpartisan approach. And this is something that we are looking at because we're government agents, working with business in a nonpartisan way, not lining up along political lines. It's a tricky road to go along, but by and large, what we're talking about in public health and I think in the social business enterprise is generally left-of-center political ideology, which doesn't always speak well to the business community. So one has to be sure not to be totally lining up with political parties in this. So this is the dance we're trying to do. So what are some of these wicked problems we're looking at? Well, obesity, if any of you have seen the Foresight complexity map on obesity, you'll know truly what complexity is. So that's a huge one. Child and family poverty, which is leading to the increased burden of chronic disease, obesity, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. We have wicked problems around the built environment, as I've already mentioned, around sprawl and a lack of access to food. And we have a huge problem with the health care system itself. It is not delivering what we need for the health of the population. In fact, as Dr. Wilbert Keon has said, he's a cardiac surgeon and a Senate, and our Senate of Canada who's led up a study on the social determinants of health, has said that the healthcare system in Canada is the single biggest threat to the health of the population. And there's two reasons for that. One is it's rapidly depleting the resources that are addressing all the other determinants, but also it has been estimated by some academics that the healthcare system itself, through errors, is the second leading cause of preventable death in the system. So we have huge challenges, very complex, wicked problems that we're trying to address here. So just Mark stressed his humility. I'm here to tell you that I'm more humble than he is. Complexity is an area that I have not been involved in for many years. I experienced complexity as an undergrad doing math and physics and looked at strange attractors and fractals and all that kind of thing, but haven't really looked at it since. But applying complexity science to accelerated social change, I was just in Cuba. Down in Cuba, you can refer to accelerated social change as revolution, but we don't talk about that here. But there's a number of things that I think we have to recognize about complexity. First of all, we never have the full evidence. We don't know all the absolute relationships in cause and effect. There's total unpredictability, constant change, shocks to the system, which we are experiencing all the time. We do have diverse stakeholders. We are going to be attempting to have dialogue with these business interests who are in some cases diametrically opposed in their interests to where we're wanting to go. So we have to deal with conflicting interests and barriers, and I'll come back to that. As Mark said, you have to have spaces where these conversations and dialogues can take place and allow creative solutions to emerge, and we don't necessarily know ahead of time what those are going to be. And this notion that small actions can have big effects, so we've got to find those leverage points and the simple changes in the rules that will make big social change come about. And as Mark also said, we have to use science here to understand when we have taken action, what is working, what isn't. But you have to do this on the fly. So you can't rely on randomized controlled trials and all that kind of stuff. You have to come up with a developmental evaluation system that allows you to understand that more quickly. And timing to go along with public, and when are you reaching a tipping point? And my sense is that we are. In Canada right now, we're seeing a wave of interest in addressing child and family poverty across the country. Unfortunately, we haven't got that wave to British Columbia yet, but it has gone across the rest of the country. So I think we're getting there. This is just something I'll flip over in the interest of time. So what do we know about moving ahead to take action and try and create accelerated social change? Well, first of all, again, as I think many people have said, you do have to have vision and you have to change mindsets. And I'll come to some of those mindset changes that I think we have to address. As we've also heard from any number of the speakers this morning, not only does there have to be intellectual engagement, but there has to be emotional engagement. People have to come at this with their heads and their hearts. And you have to somehow get the right stakeholders involved. And that's a tricky thing. I mean, as we're going about this right now in British Columbia, bringing the right business people to the table along with NGOs and the government is a tricky business. You can't bring everybody, so you've got to get the right numbers and the right people there, create the space for the dialogue, allow for emergence, and map out the whole diagram. How big is the problem? What are all the complex factors that go into, for example, addressing child and family poverty or obesity, whatever it is you're taking on? But then not being totally stymied by the overwhelmingness of that complexity and being able to identify those lever points where you can take action and move quickly to take action and get success and then build on those. And Monique, I know you hate the idea of pilot projects, but I would say we not only have to have the pilot projects, but then we've got to learn from them and move on, which is what we don't do well in Canada. So we've got to start going beyond that. Communication, 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 absolutely. This has to flow in all directions between everybody. Mobilizing resources, building momentum, that's through these small actions, and then reaching a tipping point, and as always, bringing in this developmental evaluation. So just to mention this very specific enterprise that we're embarking on in British Columbia, and I should have mentioned at the beginning that I'm standing up here because Mary Collins was originally invited, and Mary and I work very closely in the BC Healthy Living Alliance. And this alliance has now taken that complex issue of child and family poverty and reduced it to a very wonderful document called Healthy Futures for BC Families, which is available on their website, which is www.bchla. And it comes down to a number of issues that are mentioned there. The overall issue of income security, food security, housing, early childhood development, and education and literacy. So those are the kind of action areas that we're looking at to move ahead. And behind each one of those, there's some very specific policy and program issues that have been identified. And underlying that, as has already been emphasized by many, is a process of community engagement so that this is top down and bottom up. Why do we need business at the table? Because it is complex, not solvable by government alone, and as I've mentioned, many of these problems are a consequence of business processes and indeed represent market failures. And we need contrasting views to identify the solutions. How do we get business to the table? Now, that's been the challenge. We have to somehow align our interests in public health with those of the business world. We have to be able to identify champions, and this is really key to making this work. We have to overcome some barriers, change some mindsets, which I'll go into shortly. I mentioned a postpartisan approach. Determine the level of public support. Now, that's one thing that the BC Healthy Living Alliance has done a brilliant job of. So if, for example, one of the policy implications is to raise the minimum wage through government action, they've gone out and asked the public, well, how many people would support that? And the answer is about 90% of the public supports raising the minimum wage, despite the fact that the government has been totally resistant to that idea. So this is an interesting approach. Building the business case, which I'll come to, taking action, mobilizing resources. So aligning the interests. The health concerns are around the increasing burden of disease, the costs of chronic disease, the sustainability of the healthcare system, which is unsustainable for sure, the health inequities, and looking at the upstream determinants, the causes of the causes. The business concerns are about overall productivity and competitiveness, as we've heard, around economic growth, workplace wellness, and specific company profits. But many in the business community in our world are very concerned about the homeless, crime, cost of disease, and sustainability of healthcare, and many have a corporate social responsibility point of view. And as the point is often made to me by people in business, we're all in the same world together, so we have a mutual interest in making things better. So there is reasonable alignment. Through addressing child and family poverty, housing, food security, early childhood development and education and so forth, we will indeed reduce homelessness and crime. That's without doubt. We will reduce the prevalence of chronic disease. We will improve productivity, contribute to economic growth and sustainability of the healthcare system. And through advancing workplace wellness policies, which has a huge knock-on effect with families of workers, this does lead to both improved productivity and profits, as well as improving overall health. So we can, there is good alignment here, and I think this is the storyline that we have to build. Some of the barriers that we look at, that I hear this all the time, and I'm sure many of you do, there's many people out there, particularly in, loudly in the business world, that the poor are to blame for their own poverty. They don't seem to recognize that there's other issues here. They also believe, many sincerely believe, that a rising tide will raise all boats and that just by stimulating more economic growth will solve poverty in this country. Well, it's blatantly wrong, but that's what they believe. They also believe that measures like living wage that would help with alleviating poverty will have a negative effect on the economy. And then there's the famous beer and popcorn argument that we heard, I think, from the mouth of Mr. Martin himself, who people have used to say, well, if we give them money, they'll just spend it on beer and popcorn. And then there are the fears, as I mentioned earlier, of being aligned with socialism or left-wing politics. So what are the mindset changes we have to achieve? Well, I don't think it's widely appreciated that, in fact, the majority of families in which children are raised in poverty in this country are actually working poor. So these are people, two parents, both working at a minimum wage that can't afford to feed their families. So, you know, it goes well beyond being blamed on themselves. And we've also had sustained economic growth for decades, but the poverty rates have remained much higher than in more progressive countries, which also have very robust economies. So it's clear that certain measures to alleviate poverty will not destroy the economy. And the other thing I think that people don't widely appreciate it is it costs us a huge amount to do nothing in this area. It's costing us a huge amount as taxpayers to maintain people in poverty. And I'll give you a more graphic example very quickly here. So I'm going to just jump through here. The business case, I'll just mention the one on housing. In Vancouver, it costs us as taxpayers $50,000 a year to maintain somebody homeless on the street. That's the police costs, the emergency rooms, the courts, the hospital stays, the drugs, the doctors, the prison visits, the welfare, the soup kitchens, the shelters, et cetera, et cetera. $50,000 a year. To provide appropriate shelter with the supports that are needed, about $40,000 a year. So the business case is a no-brainer. And so we can go with a number of those others, but in terms of time, I'll move along. The fear about left-wing socialism in this country, the leadership in this, in some places, has come from the Conservative Party. Danny Williams in Newfoundland was one of the first as a Conservative to bring in an anti-poverty strategy. So this is not inconsistent with some aspects of conservative ideology. I've mentioned the public support. I've talked about the importance of champions. I just want to end with this, that does this kind of an approach work? And the answer is it is working right across Canada. We have a program or an idea that's afoot called Vibrant Communities. That the Tamarack organization promotes, and they're taking on child and family poverty at a community level. So this is a community-driven process, not requiring government intervention. And then in St. John, New Brunswick, we have the Irving companies leading a move amongst corporate entities to make sure that their employees do have adequate funding to feed their families. Similar thing going on in Manitoba, Winnipeg, Calgary. And in Vancouver, we have real estate developers with billions of dollars participating with government to buy up old hotels and create social housing and bring in the support. So we are seeing this phenomenon take root here, and the challenge now is to grow that and to really make it come alive. So thank you very much for your attention.